Grew up in low grav and don't spend much time on ships, apparently, Amos said. Man, this next part is really gonna suck for you. Naomi, Holden said. Get to ops and get belted in. Amos, take Prax to the crew deck and then head down to engineering and get the Rossi ready for a rough ride. Before they could leave, Holden put a hand on Prax's shoulder. This takeoff and flight is going to be fast and bumpy. If you haven't trained for a high-G flight, it will probably be very uncomfortable. Don't worry about me, Prax said, making what he probably thought was a brave face. I know you're tough. You couldn't have survived the last couple of weeks otherwise. You don't have anything to prove at this point. Amos will take you to the crew deck. Find a room without a name on the door. That will be your room now. Get in the crash couch and buckle in. Then hit the bright green button on the panel to your left. The couch will pump you full of drugs that will sedate you and keep you from blowing a blood vessel if we have to burn hard. My room, Prax said, an odd note in his voice. We'll get you some clothes and sundries once we're out of this shit. You can keep them here. My room, Prax repeated. Yeah, Holden said, your room. He could see Prax fighting down a lump in his throat, and he realized what the simple offer of comfort and safety probably meant to someone who'd been through what the small botanist had over the last month. There were tears in the man's eyes. Come on, let's get you settled in, Amos said, leading Prax aft toward the crew deck. Holden headed the other way, past the ops deck where Naomi was already strapped down into a chair at one of the workstations, then forward into the cockpit. He climbed into the co-pilot's seat and belted in. 5 minutes, he said over the ship-wide channel.
So, Alex said, dragging the word out to two syllables while he flicked switches to finish the pre-flight check. We're looking for someone named May?
Prax's daughter.
We do that now? Seems like the scope of our mission is creeping a bit.
Holden nodded. Finding lost daughters was not part of their mandate. That had been Miller's job. And he'd never been able to adequately explain the certainty he felt that this lost little girl was at the center of everything that had happened on Ganymede. I think this lost little girl is at the center of everything that's happened on Ganymede, he said with a shrug.
Okay,
Alex replied, then hit something on a panel twice and frowned.
Huh, we have a red on the board. Getting a no seal on the cargo airlock. Might have caught some flak on the way down, I guess. It was pretty hot up there.
Well, we're not going to stop and fix it now, Holden said. We keep the bay in vacuum most of the time anyway. If the inner hatch into the cargo area is showing a good seal, just override the alarm and let's go.
Roger,
Alex said, and tapped the override.
1 minute,
Holden said over the ship-wide, then turned to Alex.
So I'm curious.
About,
how'd you manage to slip through that shitstorm up above us, and can you do it again on the way out?
Alex laughed.
Simple matter of never being higher than the second highest thread on anyone's board. And, of course, not being there anymore when they decide to get around to you.
I'm giving you a raise, Holden said. Then began the 10-second countdown. At one, the Rossi blasted off of Ganymede on four pillars of superheated steam.
Rotate us for a full burn as soon as you can, Holden said, the rumble of the ship's takeoff giving him an artificial vibrato.
This close?
There's nothing below us that matters, Holden said, thinking of the remnants of black filament they'd seen in the hidden base.
Melt it.
Okay,
Alex said. Then, once the ship had finished orienting straight up, he said,
Giving her the spurs.
Even with the juice coursing through his blood, Holden blacked out for a moment. When he came to, the Rossi was veering wildly from side to side. The cockpit was alive with the sounds of warning buzzers.
Whoa, honey,
Alex was saying under his breath.
Whoa, big girl.
Naomi, Holden said, looking at a confusing mass of red on the threat board and trying to decipher it with his blood-starved brain. Who's firing at us?
Everyone, She sounded as groggy as he felt.
Yeah, Alex said, his tension draining some of the good old boy drawl out of his voice. She's not kidding.
The swarm of threats on his display began to make sense, and Holden saw they were right. It looked like half of the inner planet ships on their side of Ganymede had lobbed at least one missile at them. He entered the command code to set all the weapons to free fire and sent control of the aft PDCs to Amos.
Amos, cover our asses.
Alex was doing his best to keep any of the incoming missiles from catching them, but ultimately, that was a lost cause. Nothing with meat inside it could outrun metal and silicon.
Where are we? Holden said, stopping to target a missile that wandered into the front starboard PDC's firing arc.
The point defense cannon fired off a long burst at it. The missile was smart enough to turn sharply and evade, but its sudden course change bought them a few more seconds.
Callisto's on our side of Jupiter, Alex said, referring to the next sizable moon out from Ganymede. Gonna get in its shadow.
Holden checked the vectors of the ships that had fired at them. If any of them were pursuing, Alex's gambit would only buy them a few minutes. But it didn't appear they were. Of the dozen or so that had attacked them, over half were moderately to severely damaged, and the ones that weren't were still busy shooting at each other.
Seems like we were everyone's number one threat there for a second, Holden said, but not so much anymore. Yeah, sorry about that, Cap. Not sure why that happened.
I don't blame you, Holden said. The Rossi shuddered, and Amos gave a whoop over the ship-wide comm.
Don't be trying to touch my girl's ass!
Two of the closer missiles had vanished off the threat board.
Nice work, Amos, Holden said, checking the updated times to impact and seeing that they'd bought another half minute. Shit, Cap, the Rossi does all the work, Amos said. I just encourage her to express herself. Going to duck and cover around Callisto, I'd appreciate a distraction, Alex said to Holden. Okay, Naomi, another 10 seconds or so, Holden said. Then hit them with everything you've got. We'll need them blind for a few seconds.
Roger, Naomi said. Holden could see her prepping a massive assault package of laser clutter and radio jamming. The Rocinante lurched again, and the moon Callisto suddenly filled Holden's forward screen. Alex hurtled toward it at a suicidal rate, flipping the ship and hard burning at the last second to throw them into a low slingshot orbit.
3, 2, 1,
now, he said, the Rossi diving tail first toward Callisto, whipping past it so low that Holden felt like he could have reached out the airlock and scooped up some snow. At the same time, Naomi's jamming package hammered the sensors of the pursuing missiles, blinding them while their processors worked to cut through the noise. By the time they'd reacquired the Rocinante, she'd been thrown around Callisto by gravity and her own drive in a new vector and at high speed. Two of the missiles gamely tried to come about and pursue, but the rest either limped off in random directions or slammed into the moon. When their two pursuers had gotten back on course, the Rossi had opened up an enormous lead and could take her time shooting them down.
We made it, Alex said.
Holden found the disbelief in his pilot's voice fairly disconcerting. Had it been that close?
Never doubted it, Holden said. Take us to Tycho, half a G. I'll be in my cabin.
When they were finished, Naomi flopped onto her side in their shared bunk, sweat plastering her curly black hair to her forehead. She was still panting. He was too.
That was vigorous, she said.
Holden nodded but didn't have enough air to actually speak yet. When he climbed down the ladder from the cockpit, Naomi had been waiting, already out of her restraints. She'd grabbed him and kissed him so hard his lip had split. He hadn't even noticed. They barely reached the cabin with their clothes on. What had happened afterward was a sort of blur now to Holden, though his legs were tired and his lip hurt. Naomi rolled across him and climbed out of the bunk. "I've got to pee," she said, pulling on a robe and heading out the door. Holden just nodded to her, still not quite capable of speech. He shifted over to the middle of the bed, stretching out his arms and legs for a moment. The truth was, the Rosie's cabins were not built for two occupants, least of all the crash couches that doubled as beds. But over the course of the last year, he'd spent more and more time sleeping in Naomi's cabin until it sort of became their cabin, and he just didn't sleep anywhere else anymore. They couldn't share the bunk during high-G maneuvers, but so far they'd never been asleep any time the ship had needed to do high-G maneuvering, a trend that was likely to continue. Holden was starting to doze off when the hatch opened and Naomi came back in. She tossed a cold, wet washcloth onto his belly.
"Wow, that's bracing," Holden said, sitting up with a start.
"It was hot when I left the head with it."
"That," Holden said while he cleaned up, "sounded very dirty."
Naomi grinned, then sat on the edge of the bunk and poked him in the ribs.
"You can still think of sex? I would have thought we got that out of your system."
"A close brush with death does wonderful things for my refractory period." Naomi climbed into the bunk next to him, still wrapped in her robe. "You know," she said, "this was my idea, and I'm all in favor of reaffirming life through sex. Why do I get the feeling that there's a but missing at the end of that sentence?"
"But, ah, there it is. There's something we need to talk about, and this seems a good time."
Holden rolled over onto his side, facing her, and pushed up onto one elbow. A thick strand of hair was hanging in her face, and he brushed it back with his other hand.
"What did I do?" he said.
"It's not exactly anything you've done," Naomi said. "It's more what we're heading off to do right now." Holden put his hand on her arm, but waited for her to continue. The soft cloth of her robe clung to the wet skin beneath it. "I'm worried," she said, "that we're flying off to Tycho to do something really rash."
"Naomi, you weren't there. You didn't see."
"I saw it, Jim, through Amos's suit cam. I know what it is. I know how much it scares you. It scares the hell out of me, too."
"No,"
Holden said, his voice surprising him with its anger. "No, you don't. You weren't on Eros when it got out. You never..."
"Hey, I was there. Maybe not for the worst of it, not like you," Naomi said, her voice still calm.
"But I did help carry what was left of you and Miller to the medbay. And I watched you try to die there. We can't just accuse Fred of..."
"Right now, and I mean right now, Ganymede could be changing."
"No, yes, it could. We could be leaving a couple million dead people behind right now who don't know it yet. Melissa and Satichai, remember them? Now think of them stripped down to whatever pieces the protomolecule finds most useful at the moment. Think of them as parts. Because if that bug is loose on Ganymede, then that's what they are."
"Jim," Naomi said, a warning in her voice now, "this is what I'm talking about. The intensity of your feelings isn't evidence. You're about to accuse a man who's been your friend and patron for the last year of maybe killing an entire moon full of people. That isn't the Fred we know. And you owe him better than that."
Holden pushed up to a sitting position, part of him wanting to physically distance himself from Naomi, the part of him that was angry with her for not sympathizing enough.
"I gave Fred the last of it. I gave it to him, and he swore right to my face he'd never use it. But that's not what I saw down there. You call him my friend, but Fred has only ever done what would advance his own cause. Even helping us was just another move in his political game."
"Experiments on kidnapped children?" Naomi said. "A whole moon, one of the most important in the outer planets, put at risk and maybe killed outright? Does that make any sense to you? Does that sound like Fred Johnson? The OPA wants Ganymede even more than either inner planet does, Holden said, finally admitting the thing he'd feared since they'd found the black filament. And they wouldn't give it to him.
Stop, Naomi said. Maybe he's trying to drive them off, or he sold it to them in exchange for the moon. That would at least explain the heavy inner planets traffic we've been seeing.
No, stop, she said. I don't want to sit here and listen to you talk yourself into this. Holden started to speak, but Naomi sat up facing him and gently put her hand over his mouth. I didn't like this new Jim Holden you've been turning into, the guy who'd rather reach for his gun than talk. I know being the OPA's bagman has been a shitty job, and I know we've had to do a lot of pretty rotten things in the name of protecting the belt, but that was still you. I could still see you lurking under the surface, waiting to come back. Naomi, he said, pulling her hand away from his face. This guy who can't wait to go all high noon in the streets of Tycho? That's not Jim Holden at all. I don't recognize that man, she said, then frowned. No, that's not right. I do recognize him, but his name was Miller. For Holden, the most awful part was how calm she was. She never raised her voice, never sounded angry. Instead, infinitely worse, there was only a resigned sadness. If that's who you are now, you need to drop me off somewhere. I can't go with you anymore, she said. I'm out.
Chapter 23 Avasarala. Avasarala stood at her window, looking out at the morning haze. In the distance, a transport lifted off. It rode an exhaust plume that looked like a pillar of bright, white cloud, and then it was gone. Her hands ached. She knew that some of the photons striking her eyes right now had come from explosions light minutes away. Ganymede Station, once the safest place without an atmosphere, then a war zone, and now a wasteland. She could no more pick out the light of its death than pluck a particular molecule of salt from the ocean. But she knew it was there, and the fact was like a stone in her belly.
I can ask for a confirmation, Sorin said. Nguyen should be filing his command report in the next 18 hours. Once we have that, we'll know what he said, Avasarala snapped. I can tell you that right now. The Martian forces took a threatening position and he was forced to respond aggressively. La la fucking la. Where did he get the ships?
He's an admiral, Sorin said. I thought he came with them.
She turned. The boy looked tired.
He'd been up since the small hours of the morning. They all had. His eyes were bloodshot and his skin pallid and clammy.
I took apart that command group myself, she said. I pared it down until you could have drowned it in a bathtub. And he's out there now with enough firepower to take on the Martian fleet?
Apparently, Sorin said.
She fought the urge to spit. The rumble of the transport engines finally reached her, the sound muffled by distance and the glazing. The light was already gone. To her sleep-deprived mind, it was exactly like playing politics in the Jovian system or the belt. Something happened. She could see it happen. But she heard it only after the fact, when it was too late. She'd made a mistake. Nguyen was a warhawk, the kind of adolescent boy who still thought any problem could be solved by shooting it enough. Everything he'd done was as subtle as a lead pipe to the kneecap, until this. Now he'd reassembled his command without her knowing it, and he'd had her pulled from the Martian negotiations, which meant that he hadn't done any of it. Nguyen had either a patron or a cabal. She hadn't seen that he was a bit player, so whoever called his tune had surprised her. She was playing against shadows, and she hated it.
More light, she said.
Excuse me?
Find out how he got those ships, she said. Do it before you go to sleep. I want a full accounting. Where the replacement ships came from, who ordered them, how they were justified, everything.
Would you also like a pony, ma'am?
You're fucking right I would, she said, and sagged against her desk. You do good work. Someday you might get a real job.
I'm looking forward to it, ma'am.
Is she still around?
At her desk, Soren said.
Should I send her in?
You better had.
When Bobby came into the room, a film of cheap paper in her fist, it struck Avasarala again how poorly the Martian fit in. It wasn't only her accent or the difference in build that spoke of a childhood in the lower Martian gravity. In the halls of politics, the woman's air of physical competence stood out. She looked like she'd been rousted out of bed in the middle of the night, just like all of them. It was only that it looked good on her. Might be useful, might not, but certainly it was worth remembering.
What have you got?
Avasarala asked. The Marine's frown was all in her forehead. I've gotten through to a couple of people in the command. Most of them don't know who the hell I am, though. I probably spent as much time telling them I was working for you as I did talking about Ganymede.
It's a lesson. Martian bureaucrats are stupid, venal people.
What did they say?
Long story?
Short.
You shot at us.
Avasarala leaned back in her chair. Her back hurt, her knees hurt, and the knot of sorrow and outrage that was always just under her heart felt brighter than usual.
Of course we did, she said.
The peace delegation?
Already gone, Bobby said. They'll be releasing a statement sometime tomorrow about how the UN was negotiating in bad faith. They're still fighting out the exact wording.
What's the hold?
Bobby shook her head. She didn't understand.
What words are they fighting over, and which side wants which words?
Avasarala demanded.
I don't know. Does it matter?
Of course it mattered. The difference between the UN has been negotiating in bad faith and the UN was negotiating in bad faith could be measured in hundreds of lives. Thousands.
Avasarala tried to swallow her impatience. It didn't come naturally.
All right, she said. See if there's anything else you can get me.
Bobby held out the paper. Avasarala took it.
The hell is this? She asked.
My resignation, Bobby said. I thought you'd want all the paperwork in place. We're at war now, so I'll be shipping back, getting my new assignment.
Who recalled you?
No one yet, Bobby said.
But will you please sit down? I feel like I am at the bottom of a fucking well talking to you.
The Marine sat. Avasarala took a deep breath.
Do you want to kill me?
Avasarala asked.
Bobby blinked, and before she could answer, Avasarala lifted her hand, commanding silence.
I am one of the most powerful people in the UN. We're at war. So, do you want to kill me?
I guess so.
You don't. You want to find out who killed your men, and you want the politicians to stop greasing the wheels with marine blood.
And, holy shit, what do you know? I want that too.
But I'm active duty Martian military, Bobby said. If I stay working for you, I'm committing treason.
The way she said it wasn't complaint or accusation.
They haven't recalled you, Avasarala said, and they're not going to.
The wartime diplomatic code of contact is almost exactly the same for you as it is for us, and it's 10,000 pages of 9-point type. If you get orders right now, I can put up enough queries and requests for clarifications that you'll die of old age in that chair. If you just want to kill someone from Mars, you're not going to get a better target than me. If you want to stop this idiotic fucking war and find out who's actually behind it, get back to your desk and find out who wants what wording.
Bobby was silent for a long moment.
You mean that as a rhetorical device, she said at last. But it would make a certain amount of sense to kill you, and I can do it. A tiny chill hit Avasarala's spine, but she didn't let it reach her face. I'll try not to oversell the point in the future. Now, get back to work. Yes, sir, Bobby said, then stood and walked out of the room. Avasarala blew out a breath, her cheeks ballooning. She was inviting Martian Marines to slaughter her in her own office. She needed a fucking nap. Her hand terminal chimed. An unscheduled high-status report had just come through, the deep red banner overriding her usual display settings. She tapped it, ready for more bad news from Ganymede. It was about Venus. Until 7 hours earlier, the Arbogast had been a third-generation destroyer, built at the Bush shipyards 13 years before and later refitted as a military science vessel. For the last 8 months, she'd been orbiting Venus. Most of the active scanning data that Avasarala had relied on had come from her. The event she was watching had been captured by 2 lunar telescopic stations with broad-spectrum intelligence feeds that happened to be at the correct angles, and about a dozen shipborne optical observers. The dataset they collected agreed perfectly. "Play it again," Avasarala said. Michael John de Uterbe had been a field technician when she'd first met him 30 years before. Now he was the de facto head of the Special Sciences Committee and married to Avasarala's roommate from university. In that time, his hair had fallen out or grown white. His dark brown skin had taken to draping a bit off his bones, and he hadn't changed the brand of cheap floral cologne he wore. He had always been an intensely shy, almost antisocial man. In order to maintain the connection, she knew not to ask too much of him. His small, cluttered office was less than a quarter of a mile from hers, and she had seen him 5 times in the last decade, each of them moments when she needed to understand something obscure and complex quickly. He tapped his hand terminal twice, and the images on the display reset. The Arbogast was whole once more, floating in false color detail above the haze of Venusian cloud. The timestamp started moving forward, 1 second per second. "Walk me through," she said. "Well, we start from the spike. It's just like the one we saw the last time Ganymede started going to hell." "Splendid. That's 2 data points." "This came before the fighting," he said. "Maybe an hour, a little less." It had come during Holden's firefight, before she could bring him in. But how could Venus be responding to Holden's raid on Ganymede? Had Bobby's monsters been part of that fight? Then the radio ping. "Right?" He froze the display. "Here." Massive sweep in 3-second by 7-second grid. It was looking, but it knew where to look. All those active scans, I'd assume. Called attention. "All right." He started the playback again. The resolution went a few degrees grainier, and he made a pleased sound. "This was interesting," he said, as if the rest were not. "Radiative pulse of some kind. Interfered with all the telescopy except strictly visible spectrum kit on Luna. Only lasted 1/10 of a second, though. The microwave burst after it was pretty normal active sensor scanning." "You sound disappointed," perched at the back of Avasarala's tongue, but the dread and anticipation of what would come next stopped it. The Arbogast, with 572 souls aboard her, came apart like a cloud. Hull plates peeled away in neat, orderly rows. Superstructural girders and decks shifted apart. The engineering bays detached, slipping away. In the image before her, the full crew had been exposed to hard vacuum. In the moment she was looking at now, they were all dying, and not yet dead. that it was like watching a construction plan animation. Crew quarters here, the engineering section here, the plates cupping the drive thus and so, only made it more monstrous. "Now this is especially interesting," Michael John said, stopping the playback. "Watch what happens when we increase magnification." "Don't show them to me," Avasarala wanted to say. "I don't want to watch them die." But the image he moved in on wasn't a human being, but a knot of complicated ducting. He advanced it slowly, frame by frame, and the image grew misty. "It's ablating?" she asked. "What? No, no. Here, I'll bring you closer." The image jumped in again. The cloudiness was an illusion created by a host of small bits of metal. Bolts, nuts, Edison clamps, O-rings. She squinted. It wasn't a loose cloud, either. Like iron filings under the influence of a magnet, each tiny piece was held in line with the ones before and behind it. "The Arbogast wasn't torn apart," he said. "It was disassembled. It looks as though there were about 15 separate waves, each one undoing another level of the mechanism. Strip the whole thing down to the screws." Avasarala took a deep breath, then another, until the sound lost its ragged edge and the awe and fear grew small enough that she could push it to the back of her mind. "What does this?" she said at last. She'd meant it as a rhetorical question. Of course, there was no answer. No force known to humanity could do what had just been done. That wasn't the meaning he took. "Graduate students," he said brightly. "My industrial design final was just the same. They gave us all machines, and we had to take them apart and figure out what they did. Extra credit was to deliver an improved design." And a moment later, his voice melancholy, "Of course, we also had to put them back together, yes?" On the display, the rigidity and order of the floating bits of metal stopped, and the bolts and girders, vast ceramic plates and minute clamps began to drift, set in chaotic motion by the departure of whatever had been holding them. 70 seconds from first burst to the end. A little over a minute, and not a shot fired in response. Not even something clearly to be shot. "The crew?" "Took their suits apart. Didn't bother disassembling the bodies. Might have interpreted them as a logical unit, or might already know all it needs to about human anatomy." "Who's seen this?" Michael John blinked, then shrugged, then blinked again. This, or a version of this? We're the only one with both high-def feeds, but it's Venus. Everyone who was looking saw it. Not like it's in a sealed lab." She closed her eyes, pressing her fingers against the bridge of her nose as if she were fighting a headache, while she struggled to keep the mask in place. Better to seem in pain. Better to seem impatient. The fear shook her like a seizure, like something happening to somebody else. Tears welled up in her eyes, and she bit her lip until they went away. She pulled up the personnel locator on her hand terminal. Nguyen was out of the question, even if he'd been in conversational range.